Rebecca sat in her secret place in a hidden corner of the battlements in the consular palace. She was hidden by an ancient 100-pounder cannon, a monstrous rusting relic that had probably never been fired in this 19th century and would certainly never be fired again. She had covered her head and nightgown with a dark woolen cloak, and she knew that not even the twins would find her here. She looked up at the night sky and could tell by the height of the Southern Cross above the desert horizon that it was well after midnight, but she felt as though she would never be able to sleep again. In a single day her whole existence had been thrown into uproar and confusion. She felt like a captive wild bird, battering its wings against the bars, bleeding and terrified, falling to the floor of the cage with heart racing and body trembling, only to launch itself at the bars again in another futile attempt to escape. She did not understand what was happening to her. Why did she feel this way? Nothing made sense. Her mind darted back to that morning when, as soon as she had seen the twins, bathed and dressed, she had begun her weekly housekeeping inspection. As soon as she entered the blue guest suite, she had seen the strange figure occupying the four-poster bed. She had not been informed by the staff of the arrival of any guests, and Khartoum under siege was the last place to attract casual visitors. Knowing this, she should have left the bedroom immediately and raised the alarm. What had made her approach the bed, she would never know. As she stooped over the sheet-covered figure, it had launched itself at her with the suddenness of a leopard dropping out of a tree on its prey. She found herself borne to the floor by a stark naked man with a dagger in his hand. Remembering that terrible moment, she bowed her head and covered her face with her hands. It was not the first time that she had seen the male body. When Rebecca turned 16, her parents had taken her on a tour of the capital cities of Europe. She and her mother had gone to see Michelangelo's David. She had been struck by the statue's unearthly beauty, but the cold white marble had invoked in her no troublesome emotions. She had even been able, unblushingly, to discuss it with her mother. Her mother often described herself as emancipated. At the time, Rebecca thought that this merely meant she smoked Turkish cigarettes in her boudoir and spoke frankly of the human anatomy and its functions. After her suicide, Rebecca realized that the word had deeper significance. At the funeral in Cairo, she had overheard some of the older women whispering together, and one had remarked tartly that Sarah Benbrook had made David a cuckold more often than she cooked him breakfast. Rebecca knew her mother never cooked breakfast. Nevertheless, she looked up the word cuckold in her father's dictionary. It took her a while to work out the true meaning, but when she did, she had decided that she did not want to be emancipated like her mother. She would be true to one man for life. Rebecca had next seen the male body only last year. David had taken her and the twins with him on an official tour to the upper reaches of the Victoria Nile. The Shilluk and Dinka tribesmen who inhabited the banks of the river wore no clothing of any description. The girls recovered from the first surprise when their father remarked that it was merely custom and tradition for them to adopt the state of nature, and they should think nothing of it. From then onwards, Rebecca looked upon the enormous dark appendages as rather ugly form of adornment, rather like the pierced lips and nostrils on the tribes of New Guinea that she had seen illustrated. However, when Penrod Ballantyne had leapt upon her that morning, the effect had been devastating. Far from leaving her uninterested and rather pitying, she found emotions and feelings of whose existence she had never dreamed, until that moment erupting into her consciousness. Even now in the darkness with the cloak over her head, and her face covered with both hands, she was blushing until her face felt as though it was on fire. "I won't think about it ever again," she promised herself. "It," was as fully as she allowed herself to describe what she had seen. "Never, never again." She even eschewed that description on the second attempt. Then immediately she found herself thinking about it with all her attention. After that long-ago visit to Europe, Rebecca had overheard her mother discussing the subject with one of her friends. They agreed that a woman in a state of nature was beautiful, while a man was not, except Michelangelo's David, of course. "It wasn't ugly or obscene," Rebecca contradicted her mother's shade. It was... But she wasn't sure what it had been, except very disturbing, fascinating, and troubling. What had happened later between her and Ryder Courtney was connected with the first episode in some strange way that she could not fully understand. Over the previous months, she and Ryder had gradually become friends. She had realized that he was strong, clever, and amusing. He had an inexhaustible fund of marvellous stories, and, as Saffron had often remarked, he smelt and looked good. She came to find his company reassuring and comforting in the days of the siege, when death, disease, and starvation gripped the city. As her father had observed, Ryder Courtney was a man of accomplishment. He had built up a thriving business enterprise and sustained it, even though the world seemed to be falling apart. He took good care of his own people and his friends. He had shown them how to make the green cake, and he could make her laugh and forget her fears for a few hours. She felt safe when she was with him. Of course, once or twice he had made physical contact with her, a light touch on the arm when they were talking, or his hand brushing hers as they walked together. But always she had pulled away. Her mother had warned her often about men. They just wanted to ravish you, then leave you sullied forever, so that you could never find a husband. That was bad enough, but worse, ravishment was painful, and in her mother's experience, only childbirth more so. Then, that very morning, after her horrible experience in the blue bedroom, when her emotions had been in turmoil, she had gone alone to Ryder's quarters. She'd never done that before. She'd always taken at least one of the twins with her as a chaperone. But this morning she'd been confused. She felt guilty about her strange and ambivalent thoughts of Captain Penrod Ballantyne. She was terrified that she had inherited the bad seed from her mother. She needed to be comforted. As always, Ryder had been pleased to see her, and ordered Bakshit to brew a pot of the precious coffee. They chatted for a while, at first discussing the twins and their lessons, which, since the beginning of the siege, had fallen sadly into default. Suddenly and unexpectedly, even to herself, Rebecca had begun to sob as though her heart would break. Ryder had stared at her in astonishment. He knew she was neither a whiner nor a weeper. Then he had put his arms round her and held her tight. "What's happened to you? I've never seen you like this. You've always been the bravest girl I know." Rebecca was surprised by how good it felt to be held by him. "I'm sorry," she whispered, but made no effort to pull away. "I'm being very silly." "You're not silly. I understand," he told her, in the deep, gentle tone he used when he was comforting a frightened animal or a hurt child. "It's getting too much for all of us. But it'll soon be over. The relief column will be here before Christmas, you mark my words." She shook her head. She wanted to tell him that it was not the war, the siege, the dervish, or the mad Mahdi. But he stroked her hair, and she quietened herself, pressing her face to his chest, his warmth and strength, and his rich man smell. "Ryder," she whispered, and lifted her face to explain how she felt to him. "Dear, dear Ryder." But before she could say more, he kissed her full on the lips. The surprise was so complete that she could not move. When she had recovered her wits sufficiently to pull away, she found that she did not want to. This was something so new and different that she decided to indulge herself a few moments longer. The few moments became a few minutes, and when at last she opened her mouth to protest, an incredible thing happened. His tongue slipped between her lips and stifled her protest. The sensation this produced was so overwhelming that her knees threatened to give way, and she had to cling to him to hold herself up. The full muscular length of his body was pressed hard against her, and her protest came out as mewing sounds, like the cries of a newborn kitten seeking the teat. Then, to her consternation, she felt a monstrous hardness growing up between their lower bodies, something that seemed to have a life of its own. It terrified her. But she was powerless. Her will to escape evaporated. A shrill, high voice sundered the bonds that held her and set her free. "She's kissing him! Becky is kissing Ryder on the mouth!" Thinking about that moment now, she spoke aloud in the darkness under the great cannon. "Now even Safi hates me, and I hate myself. Oh, it's all such a terrible mess, and I wish I could die." She did not realize how far the words had carried until a voice answered her from the darkness. "So there you are, Yamal." The name meant the beautiful one. "Nasira, you know me too well," Rebecca murmured as the plump, familiar shape appeared. "Yes, I know you well, and I love you more than I know you." Nasira sat beside her on the carriage of the cannon and placed her arms around her. "When I found that you were missing from your bed, I knew I would find you here." Rebecca rested her head on Nazira's shoulder and sighed. Nasira was as soft and warm as a feather mattress and smelt of attar of roses. She rocked Rebecca gently. After a while she asked, "Now do you still wish to die?" "I did not mean you to overhear me," Rebecca answered ruefully. "No, I do not want to die. Not for a while yet." "But life is difficult sometimes, isn't it, Nasira?"
"Life is good.
It is men who are difficult most of the time," said Nasira.
"Bakshit and Yakub?"
Rebecca teased her. Nasira's admirers were no secret within the family.
"Why don't you choose one of them, Nasira?"
"Why don't you make a choice, Yamal?"
"I don't understand what you mean."
Rebecca lifted her cloak off her head and stared at Nasira, her eyes large and dark in the starlight.
"I think you do. Why is it that the day the beautiful captain returns to Khartoum, you rush for safety to Al-Sakawi? And when you find out that he does not think of himself as just your old friend, you decide you want to die?"
Rebecca covered her face again. Nasira knew nearly everything and had guessed the rest. In a few words, she had helped Rebecca understand her turmoil. Nasira went on rocking her. She started to croon a lullaby, an old tune with new words.
"Which one will it be? How will you choose? And who will it be?"
"You make it seem like a child's game, Nasira," Rebecca tried to sound stern.
"Oh, it is. Life is just a child's game. But often the games of children, like those of grown-ups, end in bitter tears."
"Like poor little Safi," Rebecca suggested. "She says she hates me, and she won't speak to me."
"She thinks you have stolen her love from her. She is jealous."
"She is so young."
"No, she will soon be a woman, and at least she knows what she wants."
Nasira smiled tenderly.
"Unlike some older women I know,"